This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Gulf War is changing U.S. relations with many of the countries in the Mideast. In some cases, the United States is forming new alliances with Arab countries. But in the case of Jordan, it finds itself at odds with an old friend. Jordan has recently been very critical of U.S. actions in the Gulf. Milton Viorst has written extensively about the Middle East. His 1989 book, Reaching for the Olive Branch, is about peace efforts in that region. Viorst recently spent a month in Jordan on assignment for The New Yorker magazine. He spoke about that country and the war in the Gulf with producer Pat Ford. Viorst says Jordan's King Hussein holds a special place in the Arab world.
What gives him a special stature is the fact that he is a descendant of Muhammad, that he is looked upon as having some sort of internal legitimacy in a region of the world where there is so very little legitimacy after all. You have to remember that this whole area of Arab habitation was recreated after the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1918. And as a result of this and the formation of nations which only exist by virtue of the British and French map drawers, the question of legitimacy is a very ticklish one. And King Hussein, at least, and this is substantial, has the advantage of having some lineage to go with, which is not the case with Saddam Hussein in Iraq or with Assad in Syria.
What have King Hussein's ties been with the U.S. traditionally?
Well, he has been the most moderate of the Arab leaders in an era when different countries turned from radicalism to moderation and back to radicalism in one thing or another as they have sought to establish an identity for themselves in this new land that became their independent countries. King Hussein has been rather consistent, as was his grandfather, of aligning himself with the Western powers. He felt comfortable with them. The king, after all, was educated in England. The country was basically given to his family by the British, and when the British pulled out of the region, he found no difficulty giving his allegiance to the United States. He also found it useful to be in some kind of relationship with the United States because of the ticklish problem of the border he has with Israel. The United States has not exactly been his protector, but it probably was more congenial to him to be under the umbrella of the United States than be under the umbrella of the Soviet Union, which was the other competing power in the region up until the end of the Cold War quite recently. And the king has been very faithful to this position, I think, from the very start, and has not wavered from it. And this whole crisis that has transpired, in which he finds himself aligned against the United States and on the side of the Iraqis, I think is a very difficult and uncomfortable one for him.
And so, how do you interpret his recent statements that have been so critical of the United States and have been greeted very poorly in the United States?
Well, King Hussein, I think you have to remember, is first and foremost an Arab. And if anything, his family represents the unity of the Arab, what he calls the Arab nation, the standing up for the Arabs against the world. It is no contradiction for me to say that on the one hand, he feels comfortable aligning himself with the United States. But on the other hand, he feels that way in terms of his Arabism as a very strong Arab nationalist. And he said from the start that he was opposed to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, and he did everything he could in the first few days to reverse it. But once the United States came in, it became too much a reminder of the old colonial powers interfering once more in affairs of the Arabs. And so he has very consistently, since the beginning of this crisis, said, yes, Saddam Hussein has got to get out of Kuwait, but yes, so does the United States have to get out of the region. It has no business there. This was a problem which could have and should have been worked out by the Arabs among themselves. Now, there's obviously been some dispute with that. President Bush has not felt that he was doing much of a job, but in effect, President Bush did not give him any time to do it. King Hussein, after the invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqis, said, give me 72 hours, I think I can work this out. President Bush apparently said yes, and then about halfway through that, cut him off, and the opportunity for working this out in a diplomatic fashion then simply vanished and never reappeared.
Yeah, I think some American analysts have hinted darkly that he's doing this because he's in trouble domestically because of his large Palestinian population. And there is a large Palestinian population in Jordan. Do they really threaten King Hussein?
Well, there is a large Palestinian population in Jordan, but I think it's an oversimplification to think that he is doing it only for reasons of politics. Sure, in any system, the ruler has to, if he plans to survive, has to function in some harmony with his constituency, including King Hussein. But on the other hand, I think King Hussein himself feels very deeply about this, and I don't think that can be in any way overestimated. He is a committed Arab nationalist. He feels that the United States, along with its Western allies, should not be fooling around here on Arab territory, particularly since the Arabs themselves, in his judgment, could have solved this problem a lot better.
Mm-hmm. But the Palestinians in Jordan enjoy quite a comfortable life compared to the Palestinians in other Arab countries.
No question about it. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons he's so strong. I don't think, certainly since 1970, when there was a PLO revolt, the king has been threatened by any internal political forces. As a matter of fact, even in 1970, the reason he survived that so handily was that the Palestinians living in his domain, and they do make up more than 50%, decided they would back King Hussein rather than back the PLO when the PLO was attempting to take the country over. So I think it's a mistake to think that he is not popular. He has a very strong sense of how to accommodate himself to the needs of his Palestinian constituency and to keep his Palestinian and Jordanian constituencies in reasonable harmony. He's been pretty clever at this and feels very, very deeply that this is something that is an Arab prerogative and not a Western prerogative.
Since King Hussein has become more critical of the United States action in the Gulf, American officials have hinted that they're going to be reviewing aid to Jordan, that this may mean a cooling off of relations with Jordan. What would be the consequences to Jordan of this?
Well, the consequences are huge. Jordan has already paid a very heavy price for what I might note is a rather faithful observance of the United States embargo against Iraq. Iraq was Jordan's biggest trade partner, and the entire Jordanian economy was very largely dependent upon trade with Jordan and with the powers of the Gulf, that is Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And which has also been cut off for political reasons. The Saudis have not been very gracious about this, and of course Kuwait doesn't exist anymore. So in effect, more than one half of the GNP of Jordan has been eliminated. There was a huge influx of money coming in from the Gulf region, which is just no longer available. And if the United States also determines that it must cut out its small economic assistance program, why, that will be another blow. But the king indicated that he was prepared for this if he had to. He said what he felt he had to say, and he said it rather decisively. And he knows he is a man who has lived with disappointment throughout his life. He is a rather melancholy figure. I've had the fortune to meet him many times. He exudes a certain sincerity and at the same time a kind of a frustration that he has not been able to end the problem of the Arab-Israeli conflict, that he has not been able to fulfill the mandate in very large measure passed on to him by his Hashemite heirs. But he is a determined man and he is a good politician, and I think he will survive this.
Jordan is the most liberal democratic monarchy in the region. How is it working, their experiment with democracy?
So far, it seems to be working rather well, but they had a very successful election, an honest election. I am a little worried, and I think there's some good reason to be worried, that this current crisis is going to foster the fortunes of the non-democratic elements of the society, and by that I mean the Islamic fundamentalists. They won about 20% in the last election, substantially more than anybody anticipated, but they are growing stronger in Jordan as they are growing stronger on the West Bank among the Palestinians. And much of the reason is certainly this grievous disappointment with the United States. It has become, in very large measure, almost a fundamentalist versus America. And the more radical you can be, the more popular you are. So the moderates are suffering rather seriously throughout the entire region. And I think the right-wing Islamic radicals are thriving. And this, of course, is a threat to democracy, not just in Jordan, but in Egypt, too. And it is for any other country in the Arab world which is contemplating democracy. The same thing is true in Algeria. I think our policy, whatever its designated objective, is certainly working against those forces which are democratic and which we putatively would like to promote.
My guest is Milton Viorst, who covers Middle East issues for The New Yorker magazine. He lives in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Milton Viorst is my guest. He covers the Middle East for The New Yorker magazine. And you've covered the region extensively and for a long time. What do you think are the consequences of this war to a region that is so unstable?
Well, it's still not quite clear what they will be and will not be clear until the war is over. I think there's probably going to be a very big difference between what will happen if the war is short and if it's long. And if it's long and agonizing, I think all of these primeval forces that are brewing around the whole region will be strengthened. If it's over quickly and we move smartly, then perhaps the danger won't be quite as great. But the war is already almost a month old, so we are getting into the point where I think it will be embedded in the historical memory of the region. And I'm not at all optimistic about the way things will shape up. I don't think we have any idea how we are going to how Iraq will be governed after the war is over. For example, there are no democratic forces that we know of that are substantial waiting to take over. And I think even more important, it would be the death knell to any democracy to come in under the aegis of the conqueror. We know what happened in 1952 after we, the United States, restored the Shah of Iran to the throne. He just became weaker and weaker in spite of the fact that we continue to furnish him with modern weapons. And gradually he fell to the medieval revolution of Khomeini. Well, I am quite fearful that that kind of thing can also happen in other parts of the region and certainly within the Arab world. We don't know, for example, in Iraq, whether the nation itself will stick together. Suppose the Kurds decide to break off, and there is an important Kurdish independence movement, as there has always been. There is also a Kurdish independence movement going on in Turkey, and suppose the two link up. It is quite possible there will be a war as the Turks themselves move into Iraq and try to suppress the Kurds. I mean, the whole thing is just replete with all kinds of imponderables, none of which are very positive. I can't think of any of these imponderables that can turn out positively, and that's certainly one of the reasons that I am so opposed to this war. Unstable as the Middle East has been for so long, in my judgment, this war can only make it more so, no matter how it ends up.
In your articles for The New Yorker, you give full rein to Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz and Prince Hassan of Jordan, who explained quite sympathetically Saddam's decision to invade Kuwait. And that's just a view that's seldom acknowledged in the U.S. media. What don't we understand about the Iraqi point of view, and how has that guided or misguided our actions in the region?
Well, I think that I'm very troubled by what I feel has been a failure of the American press and the whole American learning process. We have allowed ourselves to be dominated, and by we, I mean the country and the press, by the president's agenda. The president has not seen fit to explain what he is doing within the context of the politics of the region. There was a very serious dispute going on between Kuwait and Iraq for six or more months prior to the invasion. It was a dispute in which there was no black and white. There was something right on both sides and something wrong on both sides. This is not by any means to defend Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, but Kuwait certainly was behaving, by the testimony of any observer who has looked at this closely, in an extremely provocative fashion. Some people think that it was behaving in this provocative fashion because it thought or did indeed have a certainty that the United States stood behind it. But the fact is that within the framework of this dispute, there was a huge amount of negotiating room. And if President Bush had said, no, we do not allow, we will not allow the invasion of Kuwait to stand, which is what he said. But at the same time, he said, look, I recognize that this is a serious dispute, and we will seek to act as mediator or try to get you two people to come together to work this out, because we recognize that this is not all black or all white. And I think we might have been successful.
You know that conspiracy theories are popular in the Arab world, but you seem to give a certain credence to one that says that Kuwait, with the collusion of the United States, provoked the Iraqi invasion. Why does that seem credible to you?
Well, it seems credible because there is some evidence there. I've heard dozens of conspiracy theories since I have been covering the Middle East, which is quite a long time now, and most of them are far-fetched, not to say bizarre. And I'm not even sure that I would call this a conspiracy theory. I hate to do that only because it gets lumped together with all the other crazy conspiracy theories that we have been hearing for so long. But the fact is, as I suggested a few minutes ago, Kuwait, which is a very small country relative to Iraq, although extremely rich, continued over the course of a long period of time to provoke the Iraqis in areas of no apparent interest to itself. It would have been quite easy for the Kuwaitis to give some ground on things like oil prices and loans and the other areas of dispute. Most Arabs, and I'm not talking about Gaddafi and the screwball fringe of the Arab world, I'm talking about the central responsible fringe, King Hussein of Jordan, Mubarak, and others, could not understand why the Kuwaitis were behaving that way unless they thought that that they could get away with it because the United States would stop Iraq from acting. I think there may very well have been a decision on the part of perhaps not the State Department, perhaps some other agency of the government, to attempt to weaken Iraq economically for a variety of reasons having to do with oil and weapons and the rest. But there is, as I explained in great detail, I think, in my article in The New Yorker, a body of evidence which suggests that the United States was not quite as innocent in this whole affair as we subsequently pretended to be. Now, I do not say that I have found a smoking gun, but the absence of a smoking gun does not mean that there is not some awfully compelling information there which suggests some American collusion during the months preceding the Iraqi invasion.
Shortly after the August 2nd invasion of Kuwait, you went to Baghdad with Jesse Jackson. During your trip with Jesse Jackson, you had a chance to meet Saddam personally. What impressions did you leave with?
Well, I spent a couple of hours with him, but I can't tell you that he became an intimate pal or anything of that sort. He did not seem to me a man of brilliant intellect. Tariq Aziz, it seems to me, handles the language and the questions a lot better. You got the feeling about him that this was a tough and solid man. But between a couple of hours with him and what I know about his background, it just seems to me that this is a man who is far more complex than any oversimplified denunciation like the Butcher of Baghdad or the Hitler of our time or whatever the case may be leads us to believe. This is a man who is an offspring of the society into which he was born, and by which I mean he shares those values of suspicion and fear of a resurgence of colonial power in the region. He shares this sense of pride that Iraq is now free and will not be allow itself to be pushed around by a great power that seems to be giving out ultimatums and diktats and orders rather than treating Iraq with respect. He is a man who is insular and narrow and unsophisticated because of the background he has, but he is extremely nationalistic and extremely proud and has a very strong sense of what it is to be a free Iraqi in the 20th century. And some people, when they hear me say this, say, oh, you're just a terrible apologist. Well, the fact is, it seems to me we have a choice of depriving ourselves of any capacity for judgment by trying to simplify this man into merely a murderer and a despot, which he is, or we can look at him as having three dimensions. And I think it is incumbent upon us and important to us as Americans to look at who he is rather than the symbol of what the president has tried to make him. And I think it is unfortunate that we have really put this screen in front of our eyes. When I say we, I mean the American people in very large measure and the government, and attempted to deny the reality of a complex situation, both in the question, both as in terms of Saddam as a leader and Iraq as it is now in its place in history. The president wanted to reduce this problem to one of right or wrong. And yes, there was much right and wrong in it, but it was not the only considerations. And if he had looked at this, it seems to me, in terms of what his adversary saw and in terms of how his adversary perceived this whole thing, then I think, again, that this war could have been avoided and we could have achieved our objectives in Kuwait at the same time.
Milton Viorst covers Middle East issues for The New Yorker magazine, and he's the author of Reaching for the Olive Branch. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Pat Ford. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.